The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. Fairy tales do come true. Coming to America checks off so many boxes. There's comedy, a dash of drama, breathtaking costume design, and, of course, lots of love. One of the film's most tender scenes, however, is when homage is paid to a king's mother, Queen Joffer, portrayed by the late actress Madge Sinclair, who passed in 1995. For the original cast and day one fans of the film, returning to the story is like a reunion. For the newest cast members, it still feels like a pinch me moment. When asked what he might say to his younger self back when he was recording scenes from Coming to America on his phone, Fowler says, "Guess what? One day you're going to be in the sequel to this movie alongside your idol. Make sure to be present and to have some fun." Lane, who had yet to be born when the original film was released, shares a similar sentiment. "You are already a princess, I'd say. But one day you're going to be the Princess of Zamunda." As for the legacy of the film franchise, Murphy sums it up succinctly. "Coming to America is unique. It is rare," he says. "It's a romantic fantasy comedy with an all-black cast. And as black people, we don't get a lot of movies like this. Rarely do we get to experience escapism. To see a movie and not to have to think about anything heavy. I think that's why we love it. And the takeaway? Just like the extended royal family of Zamunda, we all deserve to be loved and live our own kind of happily ever after." The next article is titled, "The Power of the Pivot. Meet women who, in the midst of successful careers, made a hard right into a different lane. Cautious but determined, they each transferred their skill sets to new fields and built on past wins to thrive in their creative second acts." From editor to acclaimed author, in the summer of 2013, Donnie Walton's personal life was in a transition. Her first marriage was headed toward divorce, and she was experiencing the mysterious symptoms of endometriosis. This caused the Florida native to pause and reflect on her situation. Her career as deputy managing editor of Essence was in a great place. She created content, oversaw digital strategy, and worked on Essence Festival, developing programming for the annual event that inspired the film Girls Trip. But even with her cushy title, good salary, and careful savings, Walton wondered, "What am I building?" A writer friend who had been in a McDowell Fellow read Walton's fiction and suggested she apply for a prestigious residency at the Artist Colony, located in Peterborough, New Hampshire. "I don't know anything about fellowships or residences or MFA programs, nothing," Walton says, "but I'd been in working on a novel because I'd get great ideas that would spark while I was watching a film or listening to music. My ideas always started with, what if? What if there was this kind of person and they met this kind of person?" The fellowship application called for Walton to submit 20 pages of a story. As her finger hovered over the submit button, she made a promise to herself that if she got accepted, she'd jump and follow the opportunity wherever it led. Walton got in and made good on that promise. In 2015, instead of staying for the 2 weeks at McDowell, she opted to stay for 6. She then decided to leave her day job and follow her passion for creative writing. Truth be told, the Florida A&M University alum was terrified. "What I tell anybody is that the first step is the scariest," she says. "I was scared of rejection, but I was also scared of what I was supposed to do if I get this, because it was going to mean going out on a limb. But once I made that first move toward the ledge, I was fine after that." When her time at McDowell ended, Walton survived on her savings and stayed focused on her novel as she applied to graduate school writing programs. She was accepted to the highly regarded Iowa Writers Workshop, and there she finessed her fictional oral history about a 1970s rock and roll duo and the secret at the center of their fame. That work, the final revival of Opal and Nev, is now one of the most highly anticipated books of 2021 and will be released on March 30th. Walton says that making a commitment to her writing made her fiction better. Before McDowell in Iowa, she was noodling on the story and shaping it based on instinct, but focused on her craft without distractions of a day job allowed her to add layers of complexity to her novel. And even though at 40, she was the oldest person in the class, being seasoned had its advantages. "I had to come back too with a solid foundation of friends," reflects Walton, now 44. "I went in with experience, and most of all, I went in with an appreciation for the gift I had been given." These days, Walton doesn't put limits on what may happen next. She met a new love and remarried last year. She's excited to teach, work on her second book, and explore screenwriting. And she's found a work title that fits her best: Storyteller. From investment banker to cultural curator, for 4 years, Nana had a long commute, traveling 17 hours by plane from Brooklyn to her beloved South Africa 4 times annually. For the woman who'd been curious at an early age about ways to build Africa's economy and who entered college to study metallurgical engineering at 16, eventually working at the largest public fund manager in Africa and investing in roads and telecommunications was the job of a lifetime. So she and her husband, Mark, made things work for those 4 years. But Nana, who earned an MBA from Harvard, also thought about becoming an entrepreneur. There were hurdles to jump, however. "Before business school, I didn't really understand how businesses get pulled together," she says. "How do you fund a business? What's the lifeblood? I knew that I wanted to work at an investment bank. I wanted to build business models. I wanted to dissect and look at financial and be able to tell you what's happening on an income statement." Still, she had no idea what kind of businesses was in her future until her twins were born in 2017. Her parents flew in from Nana's native country, Ghana, for the twins' naming ceremony with beautiful tailor-made kente cloth outfits for everyone in tow. "Everything fit perfectly," she recalls. "We walked from home to church, and you could see the reaction. This is Brooklyn. Everyone loves theater. And they were staring like, what's this joy? What's this all about? You could feel the energy, and I thought, wow, what if I could bottle this? How can I share this?" Then she thought about the talented designers in Africa who are just as skilled as those in places like Scandinavia and Japan, but who didn't have access to the same breadth of world markets. Enter Nana with her vast network of African professionals. Through her work, she traveled to more than 20 countries in Africa, so picking up the phone to connect with a designer in Zimbabwe or Ghana or Tanzania was an easy call to make. But first, she had to reckon with going from writing $100 million checks as part of her investment banking gig to selling $50 swaddle designs. It was quite an adjustment to start from ground zero, but Nana was determined to trust the outcome. Her business, 54 Kibo, an online home decor brand featuring sustainable pieces by designers from the African diaspora, is named for the number of African countries and the continent's highest peak, Tanzania's Mount Kilimanjaro. She decided that if the venture didn't succeed, then she'd just try something else. For me, as a Black woman, it really feels good to have a piece that designed by another Black person, she says. We want to see ourselves in design spaces because once we are there, others will take note and also want to include our aesthetic. But they don't have friends in Africa. How are they going to access the pieces? Now they can find them via 54 Kibo. As Nana digs deeper into African design history by exploring the textiles, woodworking, metalworking, and goldsmithing that define it, she's planning to introduce new items. We realize that the interest is there, she says, so we are deepening our collections. We have to build our marketing capabilities and grow the website traffic and really turn 54 Kibo into a world-class brand. From ad director to media maven. One day in 1999, Bevy Smith landed in Milan for the men's runway shows wearing 6-inch heels and a golden brown mink hugging her shoulders. Then a beauty and fashion advertising director for Vibe magazine, she felt like royalty as she was whisked to her corner suite at the hotel. But when she was finally alone, Smith collapsed on the hotel's pricey sheets and cried. Her fabulous life had started to look like a scene from Bill Murray's classic Groundhog Day, and she felt unfulfilled. At 33, she decided to yell, "Cut!" She thought back to when she co-hosted the red carpet with Farnsworth Bentley for the first ever Vibe Awards, and something clicked. Everyone was telling me that I had flair, Smith recalled. They would say things like, "Do you sing?" They just felt creative energy radiating off of me. But it took another 5 years and another lucrative magazine job, this time at Rolling Stone, before she announced to her corporate bosses that she was leaving to pursue a creative life. Management thought she was having a midlife crisis, and Smith herself wasn't exactly sure how to pursue her new goal. Turns out Smith was right to tap into her right-brained self. Approximately 8 months after quitting Rolling Stone, she was offered a contract to work on Tim Gunn's Guide to Style on Bravo. Although Smith didn't sign because the contract was bad, she appreciated the universe for showing up with a confirmation code. The Harlem girl took it as a sign that she was on the right path. I never went into any space trying to convince anybody of anything, she says with her trademark confidence. I simply knew that I belonged there. I knew I was good for TV, and when I went to auditions, others knew it too. And for Smith, "No thank you" wasn't the end of a conversation, but the beginning. As a salesperson, she'd heard no all the time, so she was prepared for the rejection that came along with being a curvy chocolate woman in front of the camera. It took 7 years before she landed a hosting job on Fashion Queens opposite Derek J and Lawrence Washington. The nationally syndicated show Page Six TV soon followed, and she now hosts Bevelations on Sirius XM. Today, the author of Bevelations, Lessons from a Mother, Auntie, Bestie, is the first to admit that pursuing the creative life wasn't always crystal clear. She had a broke but blissful period that taught her how to make one can of $5 salmon stretch into croquettes for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I saved enough to pay my rent for 2 years, but I didn't realize how much of my life was subsidized by my corporate job, she recalls. I never paid for car service or meals, and I received gifts from luxury brands. So every season, I would receive handbags from Gucci, Prada, or Vuitton, or somebody. Imagine her surprise when the cell phone bill slid into her mailbox. If your favorite auntie had a chance to do it all over again, she says now, she would have snagged a financial planner before going out on her own. As far as Smith is concerned, everything was as it should be, because during her lean years, she created Dinner with Bevy, an invitation-only affair attended by fashion, entertainment, and media influencers. That venture catapulted her into a very elite group of celebrities, making all of her previous wins and losses just the warm-up. And Smith, now 54, is about to pivot once again, this time into producing and curating art collections for films and television shows. As the creative media personality likes to say, it gets greater later. The next article is titled, The Blacker the Love. Envision a future where our joy in each other, not romance, will heal us. Your slip is showing, baby. When the elder mothers of the old Black Baptist church in my childhood used to say this, my heart would swell. In my adolescent mind, they're pointing out that tiny bit of ivory lace hanging below the hem of my skirt felt like they were looking out for me. I just knew that I would never be caught out there unprotected, because there was a line of Black women who had my back. And while I've long given up my slips, half joking that they were clearly weapons of patriarchy, I've never forgotten those feelings of safety and affection. It felt like love. There is something so incredibly powerful about the way Black women love. It's sharp and pointed, honed by a society that too often downplays our genius or dehumanizes us altogether, but also tender and omniscient. We just know things, not everything, but in matters that can't be adequately expressed by words. We are connoisseurs of merging our knowledge, both intellectual and street, with our passion in order to get things done. When the world rightfully celebrated voting rights, activist Stacey Abrams for assisting in flipping the state of Georgia blue in the 2020 presidential election and again in the two senatorial runoff races in January, every Black woman knew exactly what was at work. It was our love rising above the name calling and the attempt to suppress our vote. Our love rising not just to save the nation, but more important, to save ourselves and our babies. When Megan Thee Stallion took the SNL stage and demanded that the world face its degradation of Black women, we understood that as a cry for healing. And when President Kamala Harris spoke directly to little Black girls in her acceptance speech in last December, it was more than an affirmation. It was an infusion of love. Unfortunately, when we talk about Black women and love, it's too often couched in a conversation about men and regulated to the context of romantic and sexual relationships. We certainly love our men deeply, but the way Black women love each other is arguably just as, if not more, potent. Our love for each other shows up at the kitchen table when we hold the hand of our homegirl who's grieving a loss so heavy that relief can only be found in shared tears and a slice of 7-Up cake. It shows up in the fatty part of our fingertips digging into tense scalps at the salon that feels like home. It's in the knowing the glance of the only other sister in the classroom or boardroom, the yes of the bartender with the box braids who pours an extra shot for the squad. Author and Philadelphia-based minister Candace Wilkins knows better than most the power of a Black woman's solidarity and care. When the delivery of her first child back in September turned frightening, she found herself on an operating room table preparing for an emergency C-section. One of the doctors in the room, a Black woman, asked her if she had anything she wanted to say. Wilkins was clear. Both my baby and me need to leave here healthy. The doctor smiled warmly and said, I got you. Most of us know how to take care of each other. The qualifier, quote unquote, most, is only necessary because there are some who allow fear to tamp down their empathy. But even then, the blacker the love, the sweeter the grace. Despite one-dimensional media portrayals
most Black women know that when one of us shines, we all lit. It's no wonder that our families often look less like the nuclear form designed by Western culture. Instead, hearkening back to the villages of our ancestors in which extended families included platonic relationships. The blood memory of many Black Americans recalls how we grew up calling our mothers, friends, aunt so-and-so, and claiming their children as our cousins. But I suspect we are heading toward a kind of Sankofa moment, when in our looking back, we will know with certainty how to proceed forward. In that moment, the ways in which Black women engage with each other, the ways in which we love on each other, will become the clear and present route to the liberation of the entire Black family and our communities. I'll never forget a night out at a restaurant owned by a Black woman whose team had prepared a soul food menu we devoured. As I looked into the glorious faces of three of my girlfriends, we talked about marriages, children, and careers. Our laughter, a symphony of cackles and claps, was nourishment for our souls. When we allow it, the joy oozes out of us in lush and vibrant tones, filling the room and the hearts in it. Whatever the world may see, whatever pop culture may try to imitate, it's this particular joy, this special love we save for each other that can never be stolen. It will always be our balm. The next article is titled, Your Biggest COVID-19 Vaccine Questions Answered. American Nurses Association President Ernest Grant, PhD, RN, answers some of the most Black communities' pressing questions about the COVID-19 vaccines and whether or not they are safe. The COVID-19 vaccines are here, but can we trust them? Dr. Ernest Grant, who participated in a COVID-19 vaccine Phase 3 clinical trial, answers our top questions about the COVID-19 vaccines and their risks. Should we be concerned that the COVID-19 vaccine development was rushed? No. We had the DNA sequence of the virus by January 2020, which put us far ahead in terms of being able to understand what kind of virus we were dealing with. The next question is, does the vaccine make you immune to the virus? If so, for how long? The vaccine provides immunity in that it does block the virus' ability to come into the body and start wreaking havoc. How long immunity lasts is something we are currently studying. Perhaps in the future, the vaccines may have to be tweaked to accommodate any new mutations that may happen. Next question. Should I take any one of the approved vaccines as soon as it's available to me? Yes, the longer you wait, the more you risk exposing yourself to infection and potentially becoming a vessel to transmit the virus. Next question. Do the vaccines pose any risk to people with underlying conditions like heart disease, diabetes, or hypertension? Based on what I have read so far, there are no detrimental side effects. People have reported symptoms of fever, chills, and fatigue, but that's letting us know that the vaccine is working and the body is building immunity. Next question. Who, if anyone, should be hesitant to get a COVID-19 vaccine? Perhaps people with pre-existing conditions that might cause the side effects to be very taxing on their immune system, such as cancer patients receiving chemotherapy. People in these groups should consult with their health care provider as to whether or not they are a prime candidate to take the vaccine at this time. Next question. Will I still need to wear a mask after I have been vaccinated? You still will need to wear a mask. Practice social distancing and wash your hands as frequently as possible. There may be people around you who have not been vaccinated, and you don't want to put them at risk. We would need 80 to 90% of the country vaccinated before we can go without wearing masks. The last question, am I still at risk of spreading COVID-19 to my friends and family even after I have been vaccinated? The COVID-19 virus is in the air, and it can be on our clothes. So if they haven't also been vaccinated, then yes, you still can spread the virus to them. A special note, this article is from the March and April version of Essence 2021. The next article is titled, Get It Together, Hacks to Organize and Refresh Your Home, Just in Time for Spring Cleaning. As nature begins thawing out, it's a perfect time to invite fresh, renewing energy into our spaces. Tis the season to get tidy. If the contents of your pantry are piled to the ceiling, or your closet looks more like a crime scene, we are talking to you. Sis, conquering the clutter can seem like a lot to take on, but spring cleaning doesn't have to be daunting. And cleaning connoisseur Essie Crosett, who runs the New York Area Organizing and Interior Design Company, Tidylosophy, knows you can do it. Crosett discovered the peace in organized spaces as a teenager while arranging books in her mother's Christian bookstore in Nigeria. As an adult, she turned her calling into a full-time career, living by the mantra, tidy ways, easy days. Crosett shares her best tips on how to turn messy rooms into serene sanctuaries. Work at home in peace. Wherever you are working, whether it's a dedicated home office, a bedroom corner, or a dining room table, she has one major tip. The less paper, the better. We are in 2021. People need to start developing the habit of not keeping papers around. She insists. Consider apps like Cam Scanner that allow you to take a photo of a piece of paper and upload it as a PDF. That way, all your crucial documents are accessible and easy to find. If you need to retain hard copies of anything, she recommends nesting boxes. Bonus points if you find ones with a beautiful design. Ramp up storage in the kids' rooms. Having designated areas for books, toys, and clothes is key. She recommends cloth baskets. They are large, but they are soft, so you don't have to worry about your kids messing around with the splinters of wood baskets, she says. And storage ottomans with removable lids can double as decor. They look nice, and they're portable, notes Crosett. For all your kids' books, she recommends floating shelves to keep them neat and off the floor. I love acrylic shelves. They're so handy, especially in kids' rooms. They look really whimsical. Take back your fridge. It is really important to have zones in your fridge, Crosett says. Grab a label maker and mark spaces for dairy items, cold cuts, juices, fruits, and vegetables. When you have categories, everyone knows where things are supposed to go, she explains. The organizer suggests using uniform plastic storage containers to take your organization game to the next level. Reclaim that closet. Tame your closet chaos by using uniform hangers. The homogeneity is surprisingly calming to the eye. Take out all your clothes and look through them. My rule is, if you haven't worn something in 12 months, you don't need it. Hanging your clothes by category also makes getting dressed in the morning hassle-free. Do all the tops first, followed by pants, followed by dresses, she says. To take it up a notch, try color coding too. We have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.